Hello, my name is Peter. Welcome to this week's edition of Connecticut Connections, a quick review of some of this week's top news stories from around our state. Our first article was posted to the Town of Barkhamsted online service on June 20th. It's written by Emily Olson, and it's titled, Connecticut's Pleasant Valley Drive-In Closed 2 Years Ago. For decades, the Pleasant Valley Drive-In offered entertainment with a touch of nostalgia. Drivers parked their cars on the 3-acre lot on Route 181 after dusk, tuned their radios to 87.9 FM, and turned their attention to the giant outdoor screen as the movies rolled. The beloved drive-in movie theater opened in 1947. It could accommodate up to 250 cars, showing movies on weekends from early spring through fall and drawing fans from miles away. But all that changed 2 years ago when the larger 52-acre property where it was located was sold. The drive-in has been dark ever since, and the future of the throwback business was not clear. One of the new owners of the land had previously said the town's commissions were blocking their plans to reopen the drive-in, although she declined to comment for this story and says she will no longer speak with the media. But Nada McGrain, who had owned and operated the drive-in for nearly 3 decades, said she wanted to explain to her customers why the Pleasant Valley Drive-In is closed. I've kept quiet long enough. This is my business, said McGrain, who purchased the drive-in business from the Miller family in 1996. It's time to tell my story. The new owner of the site is Pleasant Valley Properties, with Anna Smolin of Avon, David DeZentis of Canton, and Peter Driscoll of Southington listed as the principals. In a previous interview and in proceedings before town board, Smolin has claimed that the drive-in business was part of the property purchase. But Smolin and McGrain disagree on what has transpired since the sale and in the years that the drive-in has been shuttered. In an interview that Hearst Connecticut Media, McGrain explained that she owned and operated the business. She said she leased 3 acres of the property as well as the big screen, some outbuildings, and a snack bar, and said the movie projection equipment belongs to her. Until 2022, she said she paid rent to the former property owners, the Jones family. For her part, McGrain said that any plans she made with Smolin to continue running the drive-in on the property were no longer in place. Records in Barkhamsted Town Hall confirmed that McGrain was the drive-in's owner. A record of the business is filed with the Secretary of State's office, Town Clerk Holly Krause said. Town Hall records also confirmed that Pleasant Valley Properties purchased the 52 acres in December 2022 for $800,000. In 2023, Smolin said she planned to upgrade the snack bar, provide indoor seating, and add other amenities at the drive-in theater. The owners also said they want to host events on the property, such as fundraisers or craft shows, and wanted the facility to be open all year. The plans were made with the assumption that the drive-in business was part of their 2022 purchase, McGrain said. But she said, I bought the drive-in in 1996. I also owned a restaurant with my husband. Then in 2017, our marriage ended after 32 years. When we ran the drive-in together, he did all the repairs, but after the marriage ended, I was on my own. McGrain had faced an earlier challenge in 2013 when she learned that the company that provided her with movies was changing over to an all-digital format. No more film, she said. I had to get a digital projector. The cost of the upgrade was more than $125,000. I didn't have the money to do that. Following year, people did a fundraiser for me and raised $21,000 for a down payment on a $119,000 digital projector. I spent the next 6 years paying that $98,000 off, and I was done in 2022. In the spring of 2020, as McGrain was preparing to open for the season, the roof of the concession stand fell in. I found a local guy who gave me a price of $8,000 to fix it, and I did a GoFundMe. We raised $40,000. Everyone who donated $25 or more got a free pass to the drive-in for the season. I finally shut down the GoFundMe page because we had all that money. I spent it on a roof, a new sign, screen repairs, paving. Every dime that was donated went back into the drive-in. I told everyone on my Facebook page where all the money was spent. During the COVID-19 pandemic, she offered use of the drive-in for graduations and hosted ceremonies for 11 schools free of charge. The Warner Theater also did a show there in 2021 because they couldn't hold it at the theater because of the pandemic, and that was just great. In a farewell message on the drive-in's website, McGrain tells her customers with great sadness that she has shuttered the business. I want to thank all of you for your support, loyalty, contributions, advice, labor, and love. In 2022, McGrain said she was contacted by the Jones family who owned the property. the late owner's three sons wanted to sell. McGrain said, since she had an existing lease, she hoped that she could continue, but in December 2022, the property was sold to Pleasant Valley Properties, according to the Barkhamsted Town Assessor's Office. John Jones, a family member who owns a business on another portion of the 52 acres, would not comment except to say that the sale is a matter of public record. According to Town Hall records, Jones leases the land from Pleasant Valley Properties. McGrain was surprised by the news. I didn't know it had been sold at all. It was early 2023 when McGrain said she first spoke with Smolin. She said she wanted to learn the ropes to run the drive-in and that she would provide me with a new lease. But the new lease had stipulations that McGrain said she found unacceptable and she decided to pull out. McGrain says an attorney advised her and family members to remove their property from the drive-in, including the new digital projector. I put a message on my Facebook page telling people that the drive-in was closed and thanking them for their support. After that, the property owners called. Anna said, I stole the projector. She told me I didn't own the drive-in, that she did. I own it, McGrain said. It was my business for 27 years. I went to the town hall and told them I was taking what belonged in the drive-in, which belongs to me as the owner. The new owners own the property. They do not own the drive-in. Our next article was posted to the News Connecticut News online service on June 19th. It's written by Katie Govalva, and it's titled, Why and How Connecticut Experts Are Monitoring the Spread of Bird Flu. For the past several months, news has been swirling around the spread of the H5N1 avian flu, with some reports questioning whether this could become the next global pandemic. In early April, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported the first case of bird flu in dairy cows. Since then, the agency has recorded cases in over 100 herds across 12 states, as well as three human cases in Texas and Michigan. But Connecticut public health officials and infectious disease physicians say that the current risk of bird flu to the general public remains low. The good news is the human cases are exceedingly low, and they're all so far from people that they have had direct contact with lactating cows, said Manisha Jutani, Commissioner of the Department of Public Health. For a regular resident in the state of Connecticut, the risk is low. Scott Roberts, the Associate Director of Infection Prevention at Yale New Haven Health, said that the risk to humans through the consumption of animal products is also low. There's no evidence that live viruses reaching consumers through eggs or milk and pasteurization kills the virus. Cooking food such as chicken and eggs kills the virus, said Roberts, an expert of non-diseases like COVID-19 and the flu. The risk is slightly higher for farm workers, Jutani explained, but Connecticut is not currently one of the 12 states with an identified case in dairy cows. Brian Hurlburt, the commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Agriculture, said in a written statement that the department has been working to protect the state's livestock industry from an outbreak by monitoring lactating cows and working with DPH to distribute personal protective equipment to farm workers and processors. The emergence of H5N1 is an opportunity to remind everyone, urban, suburban, rural, that animal health, environmental health, human health, and food accessibility safety are all spokes of the One Health wheel. While the short-term risk is low, Roberts said that two aspects of the virus concern him in the long term, its mortality rate and its ability to jump from species to species. When it does reach humans, it's very severe, said Roberts. Of the 900 or so cases that have been reported since this was first discovered in the late 90s, about half of them, or 50%, have died. But so far in this outbreak, both humans and dairy cows have experienced only mild symptoms. In the three human cases, two people experienced conjunctivitis, or pink eye, and the third had symptoms of a mild upper respiratory infection. In cows, the primary symptom has been lower milk production for those that are lactating. Roberts also worries that the current strain of the virus started out in wild birds but has since infected several species, including foxes, house mice, bears, and domestic cats. Clearly, this virus is evolving and learning how to jump across species, and so I think the natural question one has to ask is, how long until it evolves and adapts to the point where it can infect humans? And the answer to that question might be never. Jutani said human and animal interactions have always concerned her, and not just when it comes to the bird flu. As a former practicing infectious disease physician, she advised patients to use caution, for example, when interacting with farm or exotic animals while traveling. If you look at traditionally where any of these more concerning viruses or bacteria have emerged from, It's from those types of interactions, said Jatani. In general, my advice would be that if you are concerned, then I would try to minimize those types of interactions. DPH is partnering with other state and federal agencies to monitor the evolution of the virus. There has been very good communication in terms of what information there is federally and what we have here locally. The department checks in weekly with the CDC and also stays in close contact with the Food and Drug Administration. DPH is also following the lead of the state's Department of Agriculture, since the current outbreak is primarily in animals. Agencies at the federal and state level are also using data to check for signs of outbreaks in humans. The CDC tracks wastewater data for influenza outbreaks and is watching for signs of an uptick in cases that would be unexpected for this time of year. DPH monitors symptoms for every patient that goes into ERs across the state and has been watching the upticks or symptoms related to this strain of bird flu, like pink eye and upper respiratory issues. I want people in Connecticut to know that we are collaborating regularly so that we can be knowledgeable and be as best prepared to help people make informed choices as things potentially could evolve, and that might not. But if they do, that is what our job is, to be prepared. Our next article was posted to the News National News online service on June 19th. It's written by a variety of staff people, and it's titled, Kansas Attorney General Sues Pfizer Over Marketing of COVID-19 Vaccine. Kansas Attorney General Chris Kobach is suing the pharmaceutical company Pfizer, alleging it deceptively marketed its COVID-19 vaccine. The lawsuit filed in a state court in Thomas County comes after Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton filed a similar lawsuit in November. Kobach said at a news conference on Monday that Kansas is one of several states taking legal action against Pfizer. The company said in a statement the lawsuit is without merit. Kobach, a Republican, is launching the legal challenge as the pandemic has begun to fade in the public consciousness, but anger at vaccine manufacturers, including conspiracy theories surrounding the COVID-19 vaccines, are rampant among parts of the right. As vaccines become available, Kansasans had to decide whether to get the vaccine and which one to take, Kobach said. In such an environment, it is imperative Kansans make that decision received the truth. Pfizer made misrepresentations of a safe and effective vaccine and that the company said the vaccine was safe, even as it knew it was connected to troubling side effects such as myocarditis and pericarditis, the legal complaint alleges. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have found instances of myocarditis and pericarditis, inflammations involving the heart, that rarely occur. Pfizer also said the patient safety was its top priority and that it follows diligent safety and monitoring protocols. We are proud to have developed a COVID-19 vaccine in record time in the midst of a global pandemic and saved countless lives. The representations made by Pfizer about its COVID-19 vaccine have been accurate and science-based. The company believes that the state's case has no merit and will respond to the suit in due course. The lawsuit is being brought over alleged violations of Kansas consumer protection laws. Even though vaccine recipients didn't pay for doses, Kobach said consumer protection laws still apply. The lawsuit alleges Pfizer violated prior consent judgments with Kansas. The lawsuit seeks monetary damages but doesn't specify an amount. Our next article was published in the Town of Enfield online service on June 19th. It's written by a variety of staff people, and is titled, Federal Judge Hands Connecticut Women a Victory. Sarah Salvaggi Hernandez's new favorite phrase is, so ordered. Those two words, issued by a federal judge in the United States District Court in Bridgeport on Friday, closed Hernandez's final chapter in a 4.5-year legal battle to prove that the town of Enfield and its Board of Education violated her civil rights by failing to provide accommodations for her disabilities during her tenure as a board member. In January, a jury awarded Hernandez, who is deaf and autistic, $10 in nominal damages after finding that the town and the board had violated the American with Disabilities Act and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. But this week, Senate U.S. Senior Judge Stephen Underhill gave Hernandez what she had sought from the start, policy and change to ensure that no violations ever happen again. Underhill granted Hernandez's motion for declaratory and injunctive relief, permanently prohibiting Enfield and its board from discriminating against Hernandez and other individuals with disabilities. Hernandez said the litigation and ruling represent the continuation of the civil rights process in action for the disability community. In Enfield, and hopefully throughout the rest of the country, people will know that we are equally important across all aspects of government, and it is the responsibility of these local governments to make sure that access is protected. For me, it's beyond political party. It's about humanity. It's about true, diverse representation, and I am proud of that change, and I look forward to seeing that representation broadly. Among other measures, the judge orders require Enfield and the board to create policies and procedures that will allow individuals, including elected officials, to request and obtain auxiliary aids and services and reasonable modifications for their disabilities. It also creates a system by which individuals seeking such accommodations may submit a complaint to a neutral third party if their requests are denied. In issuing this order, the court has reiterated the message that the federal jury sent in January. Individuals with disabilities have the right to participate equally in government. They have the right to have their voices heard. Anthony May, an attorney representing Hernandez, said in a statement Tuesday, "We are thrilled that going forward, the town and the board will have to implement meaningful measures to ensure that these diverse voices are part of the political conversation and that these civil rights are protected." Hernandez became one of the first openly autistic elected officials in the country when she successfully ran for a seat on the Enfield Board of Education in 2017. During her 2 years of service, Hernandez said fellow board members repeatedly denied her request for disability accommodations, which, including communicating through writing and text, taking notes during meetings, and requiring speakers to face Hernandez so she could read lips as they addressed the board. Hernandez said the board's hostility culminated in an incident in June of 2019 that made it clear to Hernandez that her accommodations were blatantly denied. "It was actually debilitating," Hernandez said. "When you don't receive the accommodations that you're entitled to, a lot of people think of those as extras, but really it's affording equity and access. It was frustrating for me on a personal level because I felt like I was not enabled to do the job I could do if I were given these supports and accommodations. But there was also repeated frustration because I didn't know what I could expect. I didn't know how my disabilities could be used against me." Hernandez said the mental exhaustion, anxiety, and distress created by the situation tore at her mind, body, heart, and soul until Hernandez reached what she described as a period of shutdown. Hernandez said she wants people to be able to participate in the democratic process without going through the accommodation denials and legal battles she endured. "Nobody should have to work this hard. So let's talk about ways that we can be more inclusive. Let's talk about changes that we can make to make sure this doesn't happen in your towns and in your communities." Hernandez stressed that members of the disability community make up the largest minority group in the country. She said she wants to spread the message that you belong, that encourage others with disabilities to hold space, not only through the right to vote, but through the right to hold office and represent individuals in government. "When we talk about democracy, when we talk about community, when we talk about people, I want to reinforce in everything that I do that you belong and your thoughts, opinions, perspectives are valuable and you deserve to be heard in the ways that you communicate. And it's not up to anybody else to define how you communicate or determine your tone." Hernandez said you have a right, literally a First Amendment right, to speak and be heard. In January, after the jury returned its verdict, Hernandez told the Current she would consider running for office if that process is accessible. After the judge's order, Hernandez said she would be honored and humbled to push for inclusion of all people, all bodies, all minds, if her community asked her to run again. "I do believe in the power of political office. I do believe in democracy, and if the opportunity came and it was right, I would absolutely run again. I've created such a tremendous community for myself, and taking this ruling back to my community is just going to make us stronger. We're strong together." Enfield Mayor Ken Nelson Jr. declined to comment on the ruling. Nelson said he wanted to avoid speaking on pending litigation in the event that the town files an appeal. The Current reached out to but did not hear from Karsten and Tailberg, the law firm representing the town of Enfield, in Hernandez's lawsuit. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on June 19th. It's written by Caitlin McCollum, and it's titled, "Connecticut Town to Review Policy After Vote Not to Fly Thin Blue Line Police Flag." A Connecticut town will review its flag policy after a decision not to fly the thin blue line police flag in honor of a fallen state police trooper drew national attention. Weathersfield Mayor Ken Lesser made the announcement at a town council meeting, during which dozens of residents assembled to criticize the council's actions. Lesser began the meeting offering condolences to the family of Trooper First Class Aaron Pelletier, who was killed in a hit-and-run crash on Interstate 84 on May 30th, and to that of Minneapolis police officer Jamal Mitchell of New Haven, who was shot and killed also on May 30th while reportedly trying to help the gunman. Lester said he'd spent several days with the town's police department in the previous weeks listening and learning. Our Weathersfield Town Council and the entire community stands with our police. We have outstanding leadership in our department and outstanding officers, Lester said before calling for civility and opening the meeting to public comment. The first speaker was Debbie Garten, mother of Detective Bobby Garten, a Hartford police officer who was killed September 6, 2023, when his cruiser was hit by a fleeing suspect. Garten addressed the flag controversy. Was this issue mishandled? Without a doubt. Does this council and the town of Weathersfield support the law enforcement community? Of course we all do, she said. Weathersfield council members had cited the town's flag policy that flags may be flown above the town with the approval of the council provided the request is made 30 days in advance. In rejecting a request to fly the thin blue line flag over to town hall for Pelletier's death. But some also noted that the flag has been used by far-right organizations to represent white supremacy and is often held in opposition to the Black Lives Matter movement. I feel you all have missed the point of this flag request, which has caused a world of hurt to me, a lifelong resident of this town for 60 years, my family, residents of Weathersfield, and the law enforcement community at large. The impact of this council's actions is immeasurable. She explained the significance of the flag to her and having recently watched her son's name be unveiled on the National Law Enforcement Memorial in Washington, D.C., of seeing the flag flown. Beyond honoring fallen soldiers and officers, the blue line flag supports families. It shows that they are not alone in their grief and that there is a network of individuals who understand and empathize with our pain. The thin blue line flag holds a deeply personal meaning for me as a tribute to my son's service and sacrifice. It symbolizes his honor, his strength, his remembrance for all he stood for, representing the bond between fallen officers, their families, and the broader law enforcement community. While the flag cannot erase the pain or fill the void that has been left by Bobby's absence, it's a powerful reminder that his sacrifice will never be forgotten. It represents society's gratitude and respect for the men and women who put their lives on the line for the greater good. Garten made her own request that the town fly the thin blue line flag over Town Hall for 2 weeks in May for National Police Week and for the Connecticut Police Memorial Ceremony for a tribute to Bobby Garten, Pelletier, and other officers killed in the line of duty. The decision not to fly the flag at Weathersfield Town Hall has been met with national headlines, a firestorm of social media posts, and even a rebuke from U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, who posted, "This is ridiculous," on the social media platform X. Christopher Breckland followed her, saying that many people have been hurt by the controversy, but that no other town had flown the thin blue line flag as a sign of support for law enforcement either. Noting that the proposal was not put on a meeting agenda but was offered without warning, Breckland called the proposal a shameful political move, but had to pause as audience members shouted expletives and objections that drew loud applause. Breckland said that the deeply divided partisan rhetoric that has infected the country was visible in Weathersfield following media attention from what he called instruments of spin and hateful networks that he named. What I find very disturbing is about the last couple of weeks is the way that people have been beating their neighbors and treating their neighbors. Incomplete, inaccurate, and false reported statements by the town council bred hundreds of messages and even death threats. This seems to be part of the national trend, one in which hundreds of public officials around the country have been facing increasing threats and harassment. I'm sorry to some of you who have been dealing with so much hate. We need to realize that the culture wars consuming national politics have no business in Weathersfield. Elizabeth Keyes, vice chair of the Democratic Town Committee, said that in her 9 years in local politics, she's never seen such divisiveness. A lot of the rhetoric we've seen in state and local politics has made its way down to the local level. Thanking the council, whom she said volunteers their time to improve the town, Keyes said, "It breaks my heart that anyone would threaten violence against a member of the Weathersfield Town Council. Threats of political violence should be condemned unequivocally by every person in this room." In contrast, John Porriello called the flag a gesture of respect for police and warned against the cop hatred agenda of news outlets that proffer biased and untruthful reporting. He continued saying, "Given the displays of ignorance and hatred towards the police by the council majority, the council would not have approved the flag request had 30 days' notice been given." A couple speakers offer their support for the town council and its decision, saying that the Thin Blue Line flag has extremist ties, while one said he had left the Democratic Party over the vote. Kristen Marino said she was a close relative of Pelletier and chided the council for not adequately honoring the fallen trooper because his death didn't occur with enough notice. Even more disturbing was the misguided comments claiming that raising the Thin Blue Line flag is racist and would cause antagonism and hate. Well, look at the outcome. Not raising the flag caused the antagonism and hate while also making a mockery of the town we live in. She called for the council to feel ashamed and embarrassed, saying that they should only have been concerned about offending the trooper's family. Jeff Rowitz, whose wife Jane serves on the council and has received threatening messages and calls since the vote, shared quotes from posters he's taped on his classroom wall at Weathersfield High School. Language has power. Resist binary thinking and check yourself. The last, he said, demands that you ask honest questions and seek honest answers constantly. It asks you to seek nuance, to trust that human beings are complicated and contradictory. It asks you to play devil's advocate with yourself, to consider what do I believe, what do I know, how can I verify what I know. The students get it, he said, and were more concerned with adult responses to the controversy than with the controversy itself. The kids are right. We need to do better. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on June 18th. It's written by Ed Mahoney, and it's titled, Moody's Downgrades Eversource's CLMP to Negative Outlook. The fight between state regulators and Connecticut's principal electric utility grew more stark Tuesday when a major credit-rated agency downgraded Eversource's Connecticut Light and Power subsidiary to a negative outlook based largely on an inconsistent and unpredictable regulatory environment. The downgrade by Moody's Ratings reinforces longstanding complaints by Eversource and downstate electric utility United Illuminating, also recently downgraded, that their ability to raise capital is suffering because what they call arbitrary regulatory decisions have undercut their ability to earn on the hundreds of millions of dollars they invest annually in clean energy projects and other sorts of grid improvements. The utilities predicted the CLMP downgrade, and it is likely to exacerbate their already shaky relationship with Marissa Gillett, Governor Ned Lamont's appointee as chair of the State Public Utility Regulatory, or PURA. Moody's, which issues widely followed reports on corporate credit worthiness, dropped its rating of CLMP, which is the Eversource electric distribution business in Connecticut, from stable to negative in a notice to subscribers on Tuesday. CLMP's electric distribution business operates under the purview of the PURA, a regulatory framework that has been increasingly difficult due to higher political scrutiny and inconsistent regulatory decisions and rate case outcomes. The downgrade applies to both CLP's distribution and transmission systems. If borrowing costs increased, they likely will be passed on to customers. In March, the credit ratings agency S&P Global Ratings downgraded United Illuminating from stable to negative in view of an increasingly challenging regulatory environment in Connecticut. The downgrade comes during an unusual standoff between the utilities and PURA. Each accuses the other of misunderstanding and misapplying utility law at the center of rate setting, rates that determine how, when, and how much of the money that utilities invest in grid projects they are permitted to recover through rates. Since spring, the electric utilities have threatened to discontinue investment in Connecticut beyond their core obligation to deliver reliable electricity to homes and businesses. Senior executives at both companies have complained that based on recent regulatory rulings, they have no reasonable expectation of being allowed to recover through customer billing what they invest in clean energy and other programs. In May, Eversource CEO Joseph Nolan said he was reducing capital expenditures in Connecticut by $500 million over the next 5 years because of a negative regulatory climate that prevents the company from recovering money and invest in the state. He said he was redirecting the money to projects in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. You can have my assurance that we will not spend dollars until such time as we have a constructive regulatory environment that allows us to get fair treatment in the recovery of our dollars that we have spent on behalf of the customers in Connecticut to bring better service, he said on a quarterly earnings call with utility analysts. The utilities acted on their threats last month by pausing their involvement in a popular Connecticut decarbonization project, a rebate program that incentivizes the installation of electric vehicle charging stations in homes. The utilities said they wanted greater assurance that they would be able to recover in less than a year the $75 million or so they borrowed and already committed to rebates. A threat to the EV program caught Lamont's attention, and he ordered what turned out to be an angry meeting Friday between, among others, utility executives and Gillette. The result was a resumption of the EV charging program by the utilities, but no one would predict for how long. The offices of Lamont and Gillette did not respond to requests on Tuesday to discuss the Moody's downgrade. Connecticut Light and Power's negative outlook reflects a weaker financial profile and a challenging Connecticut regulatory environment, said Jeff Casella, Vice President, Senior Credit Officer at Moody's. Although CLMP's cash flow will improve from the recovery of certain costs associated with authorized rate adjustment mechanisms, the long-term sustainability of this improvement will largely depend on the supportiveness of future regulatory decisions related to the company's storm cost prudency review and rate case proceedings, which is uncertain. Moody said that given the negative outlook, it is unlikely that CLMP will be upgraded in the near term. It said that could change if the credit supportiveness of the Connecticut regulatory environment improves with future regulatory decisions that improve the timeliness of the recovery of costs and investments, including deferred storm costs, while providing sufficient allowed returns. On the other hand, it said the rating could be further downgraded if Connecticut regulatory decisions continue to be contentious or unsupportive of credit quality and there is no improvement in the regulatory environment, or if CLMP's weak financial performance is sustained. Our next article was posted to the Town of Plymouth online service on June 19th. It's written by Lisa Backus and is titled, "Small Plane Crashed in Plymouth After Student Pilot Lost Engine Power." A student pilot lost engine power, causing her small plane to crash land in a Plymouth campground, according to a National Transportation Safety Board report. The student was flying a Cessna on a cross-country solo flight when she crashed at about 10:55 a.m. on June 3rd in the middle of Gentiles Campground in Plymouth. The airplane fuel tanks were full prior to her departure, according to the preliminary report. About halfway through the flight, the engine lost all power and the propeller wasn't turning. She tried to restart the engine, but the propeller wouldn't turn, so she diverted in an attempt to guide the plane to a nearby airport. Instead, she impacted wooded terrain about 1 mile from the airport and landed inverted in the campground, the report said. The pilot suffered minor injuries in the crash. The plane was substantially damaged and fuel was leaking from the wing fuel tanks after the impact. The cause of the crash is still under investigation, and the wreckage was retained for further examination. Our next article was posted to the City of New Haven online service on June 17th. It's written by Ken Dixon, and it's titled, "Looking to Become a Political Candidate or Operative? There's a Yale program for that." 67 would be political candidates, advisors, and operatives from around the United States and a half dozen countries as far away as Pakistan were in their last training session on Friday, culminating this week-long elected office boot camp run by the 28-year-old campaign school at Yale University. The students, most of whom are people of color with only a half dozen males, spent Monday through Thursday night talking and studying the science and dynamics of seeking office, crafting candidate messages, plotting strategies, budgeting media campaigns, researching challenger and incumbent weaknesses, envisioning volunteer efforts, and learning various aspects of fundraising, that mother's milk of politics. On Friday morning, the predominantly female group walked down the tiers of wooden seats to the front of a first-floor lecture room at the Yale Law School. A dozen at a time, they made their half-hour, not-so-imaginary case study pitches, first for a Republican challenge to real-life third-term U.S. Representative Susan Wild, a Democrat from Pennsylvania's 7th Congressional District, then for Wild's re-election effort in a cold country swing district of a battleground state. The candidate, Maria Montero, a Republican who in reality lost the April party primary to challenge Wild, was a case study for the first couple of groups, who spent 4 long days into evening sharpening attacks and defenses, estimating costs, projecting volunteer staffing, and calculating potential payoffs for hours and hours on the phone, mining potential deep pocket supporters for those elusive $3,300 maximum contributions. Just after 9 a.m., the first group of pro-Montero students stood up front, their slide presentations projected above them. Among the dozen was Ayanna Taylor, a member of the Windsor Board of Education, who is challenging Democratic State Senator Douglas McCrory, a 10-year member of the General Assembly in the upcoming 2nd District primary. The premise of my platform is public education and the funding for the towns and the cities, Taylor, a 42-year-old human resource worker, said in a brief interview a few minutes earlier in the hallway. In a word, Taylor described the week, which cost students $1,800 plus lodging and meals, as amazing. The concentration of the networking and cooperation with others from around the globe surprised her. She said the case study was a what if Montero had been able to win the April primary and challenge Wilde in November. It's pretty intense to show the entire life cycle of a campaign. It's real-time toolkit building. I won a campaign before, several, but to be running on my own as a standalone candidate and having this as the same time, I thought I was going to be overwhelmed, but it's actually teaching me in real time what I'm going to do right now. So it's actually amazing. Everybody is on the edge of their seat. It's been great. During the presentations, Patty Russo, executive director of the program, formerly called the Women's Campaign School at Yale, sat in the front row taking notes, while in the back, two veteran political operatives, Alida Black, a Democrat, and Betsy Anke, a Republican, prepared their barrage of questions and comments lofted via microphone for another half hour after each team's pitch. Every night, they would work with their case study group on particular elements of their presentation, determining roles, setting targets for the election win. Tuesday, they were trained on budgeting. Wednesday was paid media and fundraising. And every night they got together, and by Thursday night, they were making their cases clear, building on everything they've learned during the week. After each 30-minute presentation by the back windows of the classroom, Black, an author and former Hillary Clinton advisor, and Antke, who has managed successful campaigns for Congress and governor, is currently the executive director of Nikki Haley's Stand for America PAC, combined criticism with encouragement. Black and Anke called out Taylor's group's estimate that they could find as many as 1,700 volunteers for Montero's campaign who would knock on 130,000 doors. Those be actual engagements with voters or just more campaign literature left piled on front porches, unlikely to ever be read? And how would phone calls raise $4.1 million of the $7.3 million they estimated as a winning campaign war chest? Could they actually raise $2,100 an hour over the phone? And what is the percentage of Spanish-speaking voters in the district? What about the perceived weakness of Montero's ethnicity in rural Pennsylvania? Then there was getting the vote out on election day. They tell you they're going, but they don't, Black said, to which the team replied, they would offer voters riders to polls. Another group of 12 students estimated they could raise $11 million for the campaign with 500 to 1,000 volunteers. In critiquing what the political pros call their message triangle, Black and the group's American Dream theme was too bland. You have to have more punch, Black told them. Anke questioned why the group's target was to collect $11 million, but spend only $7 million and keep $4 million reserved for the future. The first group, with Taylor among them, had planned to spend everything but $785. If you lose by a point with $4 million in the bank, Anke said in the microphone, you're done. Our next article was posted to the Associated Press online service on June 17th. It's written by Alexander Soule, and it's titled, Connecticut Bottled Water Giant to See Split Headquarters in Merger with Florida Rival. The Stanford-based parent company of Poland Spring and other big bottled water brands combining with the Florida water cooler vendor Primo Water, with the combined company to have a listing on the New York Stock Exchange and dual headquarters arrangement in both Stanford and Tampa. Blue Triton Brands has one of Connecticut's best-known consumer product portfolios with some 7,000 employees across water brands that include Poland Spring, Pure Life, Saratoga, Arrowhead, Deer Park, Ice Mountain, Origin, Ozarka, and Zephyr Hills, which is bottled in Florida. Over 12 months through March, Blue Triton revenue totaled $4.7 billion. Blue Triton also offers ready refresh water cooler service in completion with a number of companies in Connecticut. Among them are Culligan and Crystal Springs, the latter owned by Primo Water. And touting its water cooler jug services that generated $1.8 billion in revenue of 12 months through March, Primo has taken aim at the plastic waste generated by bottled water companies like Blue Triton as a major selling point. Blue Triton has been promoting its efforts to reduce the impact of its bottles with the goal of all its beverage packaging to be compostable, reusable, or recyclable by 2030. Other Primo water brands include Sparklets and Alhambra, and the Mountain Valley water brand bottled in Arkansas. The company has about 6,400 employees today. Formerly part of Nestle's and subsidiary Nestle Waters, Blue Triton was created in 2021 in a spinoff to One Rock Capital and Dean Metropoulos, who has engineered a number of consumer product acquisitions, including a 2013 deal to purchase the bankrupt snack icon Hostess. Metropoulos will chair the board of directors for the combined company, while Blue Triton shareholders will retain control of the as-yet-unnamed new parent company. It will be led by Primo CEO Robert Rietbroek, who was hired in January. The company stated they expect to find $200 million in annual savings operating as one, without signaling immediately whether any layoffs could be coming to reduce corporate costs. Blue Triton's chief operating officer, Rob Austin, will hold the COO role for the combined entity. The company did not specify any role going forward for Joey Bergstein, who was hired as CEO last November after prior leadership stints with Sabra and Seventh Generation. Our next article was published in the Hartford Courant on June 17th. It's written by Pam McLaughlin, and it's titled, State's Longest Serving Mayor Has a Lot to Uphold. It's not just the Connecticut's town motto, but it could be, when you find something you like it, stick with it. Under Republican Mayor Robert Chatfield, the tiny town of Prospect has gone from 4,000 residents to 9,800 and from about 1,700 homes to 3,400 homes. It didn't happen overnight, but then again, neither has Chatfield's tenure. Chatfield, known to most in town as Mayor Bob, is in his 24th term as mayor, making him the longest-serving mayor and chief elected official in Connecticut. Nationally, Chatfield is listed as the seventh longest-serving mayor, but he puts himself on a rung higher because the official number six had a break in service, so he considers himself the sixth longest continually serving mayor in the United States. There's been a lot of progress in modernizing the town that transitioned from a farming to bedroom community since Chatfield took office in November 1977. But people say Prospect still has a feel of Mayberry RFD and proudly carries its actual slogan, the best small town in Connecticut. Chatfield, who coined the slogan, continues to set the tone. It still has small town atmosphere, Chatfield said. People aren't afraid to say, hello, how are you, have a good day. The mayor wears many hats. Chatfield, who will turn 81 in August per town charter, in addition to serving as mayor, is director of public works and emergency operations director. In the public works role, he has an assistant director who runs the day-to-day operations, and the latter is more hands-on. On his own volition, Chatfield has been a member of the volunteer fire department since 1965, serving as both chief and assistant chief at times through the decades. As member of the state's first graduating class of EMTs way back, he was an EMT with the department for many years, but has stopped that because he doesn't have the time to keep with the training. But Chatfield still answers fire calls during the day and is often the first one there. Chatfield also visits the elementary and middle schools several times a week, walking into classrooms, holding a dollar bill to go to the first student who could answer the question, what are you learning today, or tell them a fact about Prospect, or talk about a current event. Chatfield, who grew up in Prospect, is also a justice of the peace with many weddings to officiate this time of year. He is known for stories about Prospect. He's also known for his acts of kindness, like the time he showed up in a fire truck with Christmas gifts for a young widow and her children, one person in town said. Nazi Nujam, recent former chairman of the Republican Town Committee, said Chatfield simply loves Prospect and its people. He loves the people as his own family. He cares for them like there is his own family. Nujam also is a member of Region 16 board, said Chatfield is personable and campaigning or driving with him is like a history lesson because he can tell stories about events that happened on every corner. He has so much history. He'll give you the answers because he's seen or done it. Nujam recalls campaigning door-to-door one year, and a resident said, Bob saved my life through the fire service. Of course I'm going to vote for him. The stories of Chatfield saving lives through the fire service or helping to chance life's circumstances for the better seem endless. It's really great to hear from people all the difference he's made in their life. Nujam said Chatfield's car is always facing out to the road, never blocked in, and his boots are facing out so he can jump into them quickly. He's always the first to get to a call, so there was one time a rumor that he had been given special walkie-talkie that notified him first. We just laughed at that. He campaigns like an underdog. Politically, the town Democrats have tried to unseat Chatfield through the decades, but he's so well-liked that the Republicans have prevailed by a large margin. In the closest election, Chatfield won 63% of the vote versus 37%. Sometimes Chatfield has run unopposed, as he did in the last election in 2023, and 1 year the Democrats even endorsed Chatfield. Several attempts to reach Democratic town chairman Larry Fitzgerald were unsuccessful. Chatfield said, "Even when running unopposed, I always run like I'm trailing. I run very hard. I don't want people to think I've taken anything for granted." Chatfield, who will go into his 48th year as mayor come November, said he can't say yet if he'll run again until he discusses it with his wife, Ginny. They have been married for 52 years and have a daughter, Leslie, who lives in town with her husband and two children. Chatfield said he supports Donald Trump for president because he says what needs to be said and he's not afraid of China, Russia, or any other country. The way Chatfield does the job amounts to lots of hours, beginning with leaving the house at about 5 a.m. and into the night during budget time and on town council meeting nights. Chatfield said he believes part of the appeal of Prospect are their community activities. A huge annual car show with bands and a DJ, an over-the-top Halloween event complete with a parade and pumpkin decorating contest, and their spring fling. They all happen on the green near Civil War Monument, and he attends them all. Our next article was posted to the ctmira.org online service on June 17th. It's written by Jenny Monk, and it's titled, "Emails Reveal Divide on Connecticut Fair Share Housing Policy." Internal emails exchanged among high-ranking officials at Connecticut's Department of Housing last year revealed deep fissures between top Democratic lawmakers and higher-ups in the executive branch on a zoning reform policy idea known as Fair Share. The back and forth between higher-ups at the Department of Housing shows that in 2023, as lawmakers were debating the Fair Share policy, staff lodged staunch objections to the idea. The emails obtained by the Connecticut Mirror through a public records request have left some lawmakers questioning DOH's commitment to reducing racial and economic housing segregation. "We continue to oppose the fair share concept, which treats affordable housing like a punishment whose pain must be spread out amongst those who are the biggest transgressors," says an internal DOH memo sent in one email. "The obligation of the state is to affirmatively further fair housing, not to mandate it." Affirmatively further fair housing is a term connected to the Federal Fair Housing Act, which the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development defines as a mandate to the government to go beyond simply not discriminating and take action that ends segregation. Michael Santoro, DOH's Director of the Office of Policy Research and Housing Support, sent the email to several top officials in the department, including Commissioner Celia Mascaro Bruno, on May 26, 2023. State agencies often offer feedback on proposed bills, but the emails, which were shared between DOH officials but not sent to lawmakers, provide a window into executive branch opposition to a priority proposal by Democratic legislative leadership. The fair share policy would have the state assess regional housing needs, then divide that need up among towns. Each municipality would be responsible for planning and zoning for a certain number of units of affordable housing. I think it was just really unfortunate and concerning to see the opinions being expressed by a staff person at the Department of Housing about fair housing questions, or suggesting that the intent there is to punish communities as opposed to holding them accountable, said House Majority Leader Representative Jason Rojas, Democrat from East Hartford. Santoro sent his email toward the end of the session, and lawmakers were still negotiating major pieces of what was meant to be a sweeping housing bill that bolstered renter rights, reformed statewide zoning policy, and substantially increased the housing stock in Connecticut. Ultimately, the bill became largely focused on renters' rights and did nothing to increase housing stock. I think it speaks volumes of how hard an effort it is to try to make progress on this when perhaps the Department of Housing, of all agencies, is obstructing this, Rojas said. He and other Democrats said they thought the emails showed a general attitude toward affordable housing at DOH that doesn't match the work of lawmakers. Julia Bergman, a spokesman for Governor Ned Lamont's office, said in a written statement to the CT Mirror that the email doesn't reflect the governor's view on fair share. The governor believes in incentivizing towns and cities to pre-zone areas that are prime for housing development, with municipalities taking the lead on where they want those units to go. In a written statement, Mosquera Bruno explained her view of the department's role in the legislative process, but didn't directly address fair share. During any legislative session, the Department of Housing is asked for input on various concepts and bills as drafted. We provide that input from our unique perspective as the agency that implements policies voted favorably by the legislature and signed into law by the governor. A spokesperson for the department declined an interview request from the CT Mirror. Democratic leaders say they think the messages show behind-the-scenes efforts to push back against legislation and provide a look at the executive branch's unwillingness to be aggressive in ensuring all towns are building more housing. Their statement indicated an attitude within the department that is not necessarily friendly to what we're trying to advance, said Senate President Pro Tem Martin Looney, Democrat from New Haven. He said he thinks it shows that DOH doesn't want to challenge towns that have done little to create more affordable housing. It seems to take an attitude that they really don't have to worry about being forced to do anything. Republican lawmakers expressed frustration that DOH didn't make the views known more broadly during the 2023 session. They want more information, they said, while they were debating the bill. It's frustrating and it's disheartening that we don't hear from them, said Housing Committee Ranking Member Representative Tony Scott, Republican from Monroe. There are so many times that we have public hearings and we have bills where we don't even get any kind of feedback. I don't know if they like it or don't like it. That's what the committee process is for, so I'm not getting it. Connecticut is one of the many states grappling with a lack of housing and discussing how to address that need through zoning changes. The state lacks about 92,000 units of housing that are affordable and available to its lowest income residents. Thousands of families are paying more than a third of their income for housing costs. Supply of homes for sale is low and homelessness is increasing. Housing instability can have wide-ranging effects on people's health, economic security, and community ties, among other outcomes. The conflict is emblematic of the ongoing zoning debate at the state capitol. Housing advocates and many lawmakers want to implement policies that require towns to allow developers to build more apartments. Others push for incentive-based methods that encourage towns to allow development. It is a perpetual debate among lawmakers and policy experts. Those who argue for incentive-based approaches say that takes into account the unique needs of towns and preserves local control. But housing experts have argued that towns have had years to allow more development and many still won't take action. So they say the state needs to step in. Lamont has steered clear of publicity criticizing the fair share policy, although he said many times that he prefers incentive-based methods and wants to focus on transit-oriented development. The governor is particularly encouraging cities and towns to identify areas around transit hubs where housing could be built. The governor is committed to significantly increasing the availability of affordable housing stock in Connecticut and simplifying the approval process for getting those projects completed. Currently, work is underway on a fair share study, and we look forward to the results. Many key lawmakers who work on housing and zoning issues said they weren't aware that DOH officials had any stance on the fair share policy, let alone one that leaves so little room for doubt. The challenge that we're all facing is we all know we are at least 100,000 units short of housing, said Planning and Development Co-Chair Representative Eleni Kavros-DeGraw, Democrat from Avon. I think that where our disconnect is, and probably where the Department of Housing's disconnect is, how we're going to accomplish it. Rojas said he had conversation with DOH officials about objections to the policy, but not to the extent the emails show. Our next article was posted to the Town of Cheshire online service on June 18th. It's written by Austin Mermina, and it's titled, Cheshire to Build Miracle Field for Athletes with Disabilities. Cole Kubitska joined the town's adaptive baseball program about 10 years ago and recently progressed to whacking the ball off a batter's tee by himself, according to his mom. But pushing Cole's wheelchair around the bases or through a tall grass at the program's home field at Darcy Elementary School has always been a struggle. Darcy Field oftentimes is muddy if we get a lot of rain and we can't push him in the mud, the mother said. The grass is sometimes long and it's hard to maneuver the wheelchair. After more than 30 years of battling poor conditions at their current home, Cole Kubitska and his teammates will soon play on a new custom-made diamond called a Miracle Field, which will better suit their needs. The field, which will be built at Bartlett Park, uses a $750,000 grant approved by the State Bond Commission earlier this month will improve access to the game for players of all abilities, including those who use walkers and wheelchairs. The facility also will be located in a more inclusive environment where other sports teams play. The Cheshire Challengers, a program for athletes with disabilities, has struggled with the field conditions at Darcy School, where the team has played since 1991, according to Derek Hayden, one of the team's coaches and the director of the Cheshire Youth Baseball and Softball's Challenger Division. The field's poor drainage often leads to flooding, creating problems for children with mobility issues as they move around the soppy base paths. Several players have gotten their wheelchairs stuck in the mud. The league has delayed the start of some seasons by a few weeks because of the especially rainy weather. Parking also has been an issue, requiring players to travel across pavement and gravel without ramps to get to the field. Instead of grass and dirt, the fully accessible Miracle Field will be made with synthetic turf, ensuring greater mobility. It also will have large dugouts that can accommodate wheelchairs and bathrooms compliant with the American with Disabilities Act. It means everything that we can pour our effort into making sure our athletes have the best experience they can have without worrying about conditions of the field interfering with their safety or experience. The town's Miracle Field will be the fourth such amenity in the state, according to State Representative Liz Linehan, Democrat from Cheshire, who helped secure the funding. The field will serve as the regional site for other adaptive sports programs in central Connecticut, bringing economic benefits for Cheshire. The total cost to build the field was not immediately known, though Cheshire is prepared to appropriate up to a certain amount. This inspiring project will open doors for Cheshire area residents with disabilities, granting them safe opportunities for physical fitness, social interaction, and community participation, said Senator Jan Hochstetler, Democrat from Meriden. Because it can accommodate several sports, like Miracle Field, will allow the town to expand its athletic opportunities for children with disabilities. I'm so excited Cheshire has gotten behind this because the town is super supportive of adaptive sports. At Bartlam Park, one of the town's busiest recreational areas, the Challengers will have a greater presence in the community compared to their current field, which will be demolished to make way for a new elementary school. That's all for this week's Connecticut Connections. If you have any questions about the articles read today or other programs at Chris, please call the Chris Listener line at 860-727-9579. This is Peter. So long until next time.